Rufus Wainwright once sang the words, "California, California, such a wonder that I think I'll stay in bed." Welcome to episode 31 of Our Hen House, a place to find our way to change the world for animals. On today's episode, we come to you from Big Sur, California, where we are searching for good food, breathless from the scenery, and trying to weed out an offensive word from my vocabulary. Awesome. Joining us today is animal and environmental lawyer David Cossuto, who will talk to us about some of the intersections between those overlapping areas. In our review section, Kyle Neese, a California boy himself, will give us the skinny on faux gras, and we really mean faux gras.
As in vegan.
All that, some vegan banter, and of course, current events from the world of animal rights. My name is Jasmine Singer, and I'll be your co-host today in our hen house, along with my California dreamer, Marianne Sullivan.
Hi.
We're delighted you've joined us today in our hen house, where August approached just in time for us to get out our heaviest sweaters. Gotta love Northern California. Now please, pull up some hay. Let's get squawking. I'd like to welcome my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
Hello, my little California mama.
Because we are still in California, but I am not your mama. However, I did go to a restaurant called Gracias Madre in San Francisco that made me say thank you, mommy, over and over again.
Yeah, and I didn't get to go, which makes me say, damn it, mommy.
That's the nickname for the restaurant. It's actually fuck you, mommy. But it was very delicious. We're not in San Francisco anymore right now. We are in Big Sur. But we did have a great few days after our podcast last aired in San Francisco, where in addition to Gracias Madre, we ate at Millennium, which was attached to the hotel we were staying at, the Hotel California.
Yeah, actually, it was a dinner that we had for the Bar Association people who were participating in our continuing legal education program, and I think it came off very, very nicely. There were a lot of people there who weren't. It was a group of about 15. A lot of them weren't vegan, and I must say, I think it must have made a fabulous impression, because I thought it was great. And I didn't love Millennium the last time I went there, and this time I totally loved it.
Yeah, I really liked it, too. It's a whole lot better than the food we've been having in Big Sur, but that's another story. Crafty Gratitude in San Francisco was also quite delicious, and everything you order is like, I'll have the I Am Fabulous, I'll have the I Am Beautiful, and of course, I ordered the I am a little richer than I really am in real life, and the I look 20 pounds thinner than I really am.
It
didn't work, but it was
The food there was delicious, and the atmosphere was very California cool.
Mm-hmm. And you became the chair of the Animal Law Committee. Finally, we keep talking about it. It finally happened. You are a chair. How does it feel to be a chair?
I have the crown. I have been crowned. Yeah, it feels a little actually nerve-wracking, I must say. It feels like it's going to be a lot of work, but I'm excited. I hope we're going to be able to do some exciting things this year.
The day before we left City by the Bay, I believe they call it, we actually went to the Presidio, where there was an animal exhibit there, which was kind of weird. It was like animals in the wild exhibit, and there was like a chair that was yellow that was supposed to be art, and you were supposed to sit in it and look at pelicans or something.
Actually, it was herons. And just to clarify, when you say animal exhibit, they were of course not exhibiting animals, which we wouldn't have gone to see. It was various artists had done work that either looked like animal habitat or actually was meant to become animal habitat, works of art that were meant to draw animals in order to live in them. The particular yellow chairs was meant to give you the perspective of looking at a field from the viewpoint of the heron. The Presidio is so weird because it's being like in the wilderness. You're in the middle of San Francisco, but it's so deserted, and the area where we were was completely deserted, and it was very chilly out, as it always is apparently in San Francisco, and the whole thing felt kind of eerie.
Mm-hmm. Well, something else that was also eerie and beautiful in a much different way than the Presidio was an event that we volunteered for with the Animal Law Committee for the pit bull advocacy group called Bad Rap.
Yeah, I think we had spoken about this before, so now it's actually happened. They do vaccination clinics in very poor neighborhoods where most of the people who have dogs have pit bulls, or a great many do anyway, and over 100 dogs were vaccinated, and it was both very wonderful and very depressing because, I mean, so few people were interested in the free spay neuter vouchers that were offered. They were just horrified at the thought, and some people came in with laundry baskets full of puppies, and it was all just kind of overwhelming how difficult a problem, even the companion animal problem, still is, how many people just really don't get it. But on the other hand, we met a lot of really, really nice people, and we met a whole lot of wonderful, wonderful dogs.
And the pit bull puppies, obviously, is incredibly sad because, you know, somebody actually asked me if I wanted to purchase one, but it's very, very sad. But they're so cute. Oh, my God. There's kind of nothing cuter than pit bull puppies.
Yeah, they were completely adorable.
And that night, we went to our favorite theater, the Castro Theater in the Castro, and we saw Giant with James Dean.
Yes, and he was as good an actor as everybody says he was.
I love him. You know, when I was 17, I was in a summer stock production called Alone in the Rain, the James Dean story, and I played Dizzy, who was his girlfriend. And
who is
Liz Sheridan, who played Seinfeld's mother.
Now, I keep telling Jasmine that that's really hard to put together, that Seinfeld's mother was James Dean's girlfriend.
Well, Seinfeld's mother, the actress who played Seinfeld's mother on Seinfeld, Liz Sheridan, was Dizzy Sheridan, who I played. And she actually wrote this great book called Me and Jimmy, and it was about her relationship with James Dean. And that movie, which was, by the way, 3.5 hours long with a 15-minute intermission, was really incredible. Nobody pulls off drunk quite like James Dean.
Yeah, and it was also a really interesting movie. I think it must have been made in the very early 60s, and it obviously was a very political movie. And
I would say late 50s.
Possibly. We'll have to look that up. God forbid we should provide actual information on our podcast.
There was an animal rights scene in the movie Giant.
Yeah, first of all, I was going to say it had a really strong civil rights theme, and I think it was probably shortly before the Civil Rights Act was passed, and I think was probably filmed with an effort to promote the passage of that law. But the other exciting thing about it was that it had a really strong animal rights scene where the kids, young children, had made friends with the turkey. What was the turkey's name?
Pedro.
All right, Pedro. And they found out on Thanksgiving Day that the corpse lying on the table belonged to Pedro, and they screamed and cried and carried on and wouldn't eat it.
I know, and they said, is that Pedro? Is that Pedro? And by the way, one scene is the kids feeding the turkey, and the next scene flashed to the turkey being served, and everyone in the audience laughed, and I was like, fuck you, you stupid, unethical fucks. But I didn't say that, but I thought it.
Always the good activist.
And so then the kids were like, that's Pedro? Is that Pedro? And they start crying, and everyone starts laughing, and of course I start applauding. So they were great. That was a really good scene. I really liked that scene very much. And all in all, San Francisco was great, except for I had a really bad experience leaving San Francisco.
Yeah, I keep hearing about this over and over again, so you might as well tell the people out there about it.
Well, and I'm not going to harp on it. By the way, we're outside, so if you hear little rascally kids, it's because we're outside recording this. So I was leaving. You were at your meeting. So I had all of our luggage with us, and I got in the elevator at the Hotel California to go check out. And I'm in the elevator by myself on the 6th floor. And we get to the 5th floor, and we pick up a woman and her, I guess, husband and their little 8-year-old daughter, and the door is closed, and we're on the 5th floor, and I'm wearing my herbivore sweatshirt. It's just a black sweatshirt with the words herbivore, like, small in the sort of left breast pocket area, not that there's a pocket. And this woman looked at it, and she said, and she, like, kind of scoffed, and she said to her husband really loudly and really theatrically, I think I'm going to have a steak tonight. And he said, yeah. And she said, yeah, really bloody and just killed. And then he looked at me, and he's noticed my sweatshirt, and he looks at the ground and starts laughing and shaking his head. And she's like, I don't care if it's a fish or a cow or a pig, as long as it's dead. I want meat, meat. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, I didn't even know what to say because it was so passive aggressive. You know, it's so much easier to say something when it's so overtly to you.
Yeah, I'm very pleased that you did say something. I must say, I don't think I would have bothered when you run into that kind of hostility.
Well, first I said, that's really funny. And she looked at, which isn't, you know, a great comeback, but she looked at me and she's like, excuse me? And I'm like, it's really, you know, I noticed you looked at my shirt and then you made those ridiculously third grade jokes about eating animals. And it's just, I wanted you to know that's very funny. And she's like, I would never. I eat non-animal food all the time. I eat pasta and salad. And I'm like, well, obviously you were just being antagonistic. And by now she's like walking away. And it's like, you stupid fuck. And you know what's the worst part? It affected me. Like, I really can't stop thinking about it.
I know, and you can't stop talking about it either. It really did. I don't know why you would let that horrible woman get to you and ruin your day, but I know sometimes it's hard to avoid.
I was wearing a sweatshirt that said herbivore.
Right. Really a hostile, you hostile person,
right.
You.
I know, exactly. But anyway, I don't want to harp too much on it. It's just people are dumb fucks, basically. But we are in Big Sur right now, not to be confused with Big Madam.
Yeah, and surprisingly, the food sucks.
Yeah. They're like Hippieville, and all the stores have all natural, you know, quote-unquote natural stuff. And they have, like, lots of stuff that wasn't tested on animals, which is awesome. But there's, like, no vegan food to be found anywhere.
Yeah, in the first place, all the food is ridiculously expensive. The restaurants are not anything great, and they're very, very expensive. But then there's nothing on the menu.
Well, yeah, there's, like,
maybe a veggie burger.
Right, which we had last night, a veggie burger, which was crazy expensive. And other than that, we've basically been, like, eating cereal and soy milk that we bought at the store and, like, peanut butter crackers, which is pretty good, I gotta say. And the drive here and just driving around here is kind of insanely gorgeous.
Yeah, this is one of the most beautiful places on earth. Though I have to say the driving's a little terrifying.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty terrifying. And yesterday we went to the moon.
We can explain why it's terrifying so people don't think I'm just a lousy driver.
I guess that's a good point.
That Highway 1 is just at the top of a lot of huge, huge high... If you haven't done it, and I know many people have, huge high cliffs that drop down to the ocean. And it's breathtakingly beautiful and also a bit scary.
Yeah, it really is like nowhere else I've ever seen. It reminded me a little bit of the Grand Canyon, except for there was no water... like this at the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, the Grand Canyon with ocean.
Right, exactly. And yesterday we went to the moon.
Yeah, the beach we went to was just, what a crazy...
Pfeiffer State Beach.
Crazy landscape. It really did feel like we were on another planet.
It was gorgeous. My ideal beach is a beach where you have to wear a sweatshirt.
Yeah, well, it's still chilly here in California. It's not quite as cold as it was in San Francisco, but yesterday was really cold because it was overcast. And the beach was chilly, but we found a nice little secluded corner looking out on a just unbelievably beautiful beach, and we had a very happy day.
It was a wonderful day. And we rented a zip car, which is how we got here. It's a lovely little hybrid called Isadora, I believe they named her. And it's lovely, really lovely. And when we were in the car, we listened to a couple old podcast episodes, and I had this really icky observation of myself that my favorite adjective is apparently awesome.
Yeah, that is true. And first, I would like to clarify that we do occasionally listen to other things than ourselves. That just happened to be. We needed to review a couple of things.
Right.
Yeah, I've noticed before that, well, particularly since we're here in California, like the dude who took our money to get into the beach parking lot, he was like, "Oi, awesome, guys. That's..." And it really is California surfer dude land, and you fit right in because you do use that word kind of a lot.
And I sound like I'm drunk sometimes because very frequently we'll record very late at night at like 2, 3 a.m. I have no idea why, especially as of late. It's the only time we have to record, and I guess my speech is slurring or something. I sound like
that, or it's the two bottles of wine you drank.
That's possible, too. Well, somebody who's on our podcast today who is, to my knowledge, not drunk is David Cassuto.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to speaking to David. He is one of the brightest minds in animal law, I would say.
Well, I'm curious to hear what he has to say then. So let's just get right into that interview. David Cassuto is a professor of law at Pace Law and executive director of the Brazilian American Institute on Law and Environment. He specializes in animal law, water law, and international comparative law. He also just completed a stint as Fulbright scholar and visiting professor of law at the Getulio Vargas Foundation School of Law in Rio de Janeiro. In addition to the Animal Law blog, which is found at Animal Blog, that's animalblawg.wordpress.com, where he blogs regularly on animal law and policy, he has also written a fair amount for the print media. Among his recent works number The CAFO Hot House, Climate Change, Industrial Agriculture, and the Law, Owning What You Eat, The Discourse of Food, and Bread Meat, The Cultural Foundation of the Factory Farm. He also co-edited an animal law reader for law students entitled Animal Law and the Courts. He speaks frequently on all sorts of environmental and animal issues all over the world. Welcome to our hen house, David Cassuto.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We're very excited to have you, another lawyer fellow, joining us today. Marianne's a lawyer fellow, I think. Is that what you would call yourself?
No, I'm a lawyer gal.
A lawyer gal.
She has a lot of gender confusion.
I guess I do.
Well.
So, David, you are one of the few people to come at animal law from an environmental law background. Do you think that that gives you a different perspective than some others in the field?
I hope so. I mean, I think it is. I mean, for example, I came to the environmental field from a humanities background, and that took me to the law, and the environmental field and the law took me to the animal field. So yes, I think it does give me a different perspective. Whether it's more or less valuable, I don't know, but I feel like it informs my worldview.
So why do you think that environmentalists and animal protection people have such a hard time working together?
I think this is a fascinating question, and I think it has to do with a sort of purist streak in both communities. I always think of it in terms of, I compare it to, for example, the Republicans of the 1990s and early 2000s as compared to the Democratic Party pretty much forever. The Republicans got in lockstep and started, regardless of their internal disagreements, they voted with the leadership all the time. And because they did that, they were able to accomplish a great deal that, you know, very little of it good, in my view, but they accomplished a lot simply by having that kind of discipline. Whereas the Democratic Party tends to have more of a communitarian approach and looks for consensus, and as a result, the schisms and fractures tend to hold up any sort of progress. I think there's this, and I greatly admire those traits. I mean, I think it's very respectful, but I think what's happened with respect to the environmentalists and the animal advocacy community is that both sides feel strongly about their respective positions, and they align probably 90% of the time, but that other 10% of the time, because both sides feel so strongly, and because there tends to be this big tent approach to things, they lose focus and end up feeling antagonistic.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight. So what do you think this 10% of issues focuses on primarily?
Well, you know, when I teach animal law, I'm often teaching animal law to, at Pace, most of the people who take my animal law class are environmental folks. And so the way I explain it to them is, for if you have an island and you have an invasive animal species, an environment, and it's destroying the local ecosystem, and say there's no easy way to deal with the problem, because you can't, it's not like you can just trap a few of, you know, them and take them off. It's one of these things where you can't get all of them. Say, for example, it's a burrowing rodent or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, this is a very real world problem in many areas.
It is, in fact, a very real world problem, and there have been a number of court cases about it, and it gets very interesting for this reason. So here you are, you have these animals who probably came to the island through human intervention, and they're there just doing what animals do, but they're destroying the ecosystem very rapidly. So here would be an interesting place where probably the animal community and the environmentalist community would diverge. Environmentalists would say, well, you know what, we have to kill them all. because otherwise the ecosystem will be savaged,
right,
and the greater good is for the ecosystem. Whereas the animal advocacy community might say, you know what, each one of these beings has its own right to life. You wouldn't say that about people if they were on that island. You have to take account for the individual liberty interests,
exactly,
of these particular animals. And so here, you know, and I think there's a great, I respect both positions. I understand that there's a great, you know, a great deal of well-intentioned good behind each position, but they don't agree. And so that causes friction because both sides feel very strongly. And whereas I think, you know, getting back to the Democrat-Republican analogy, whereas the Republicans would just kind of push that issue off to the side and say, you know what, let's not deal with this right now, I think the animal advocacy and the environmentalist community tend to focus on these things.
Yeah, exactly. They really tend to focus on where they disagree. And I, to tell you the truth, I think that most animal advocates would, maybe not all, but most would be like you, having respect for the environmental position in the sense that they also are very concerned about the ecosystem and about the indigenous wildlife, but mm-hmm. but then they have the additional problem of respecting the individual lives of the invasive species, so it becomes a much more complex problem.
I think that's right. I think most most animal advocates would self-identify as environmentalists. And
I think that
probably a lot of environmentalists would self-identify as animal advocates, except that they tend to feel, I think, probably more knee-jerk hostility. You know, that is to say, I think there's a little bit of, well, here, let me start over with that. Okay, I think the environmental advocacy community has a little bit more suspicion of the animal advocacy community.
Yeah, I think they like to eat meat too.
Well, there's that. Yeah, and that's a tough thing. You know, at Pace, for example, over the years that I've been there, and it's, I don't know, 7 or 8 years now, the Environmental Law Society has gone from having annual barbecues where there was no thought given whatsoever to what they were serving, to serving grass-fed meat. And then I believe, don't quote me on this because I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that they now have vegan barbecues.
Well, they better,
wow.
Damn it.
Totally vegan barbecues?
I don't know because I haven't been to the last one or two. I know they have vegan Thanksgivings.
Right.
That's very cool. I'm totally impressed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, and what I think it symbolizes, regardless of whether, you know, whether or not it's purely this or purely that, I look at it as enormous progress because of the outreach involved.
Sure.
The Student Animal Legal Defense Fund and the Environmental Law Society are working together,
mm-hmm.
and they're really trying to find common ground, which is so important and so much what this is all about.
Yeah, that's really great progress. It's nice to hear that. David, you were recently in Brazil. Tell us why.
I was there because I was lucky enough to score a Fulbright grant,
mm-hmm.
and I was a visiting professor at the Getulio Vargas School of Law in Rio de Janeiro,
wow.
which was a great gig.
Rio is
a fabulous city. And you probably want to know, did I take beach volleyball lessons? The answer is yes.
We were actually going to ask if you did anything productive, but I guess you could consider it productive as well.
Are you kidding me? I learned how to spike. No, I'd say, you know, if I were 20-something years younger and had about 3 feet more hang time and 12 inches more height, I would be a monster out there.
Wow. Yeah. That's very close. You're very close.
But for those things. Yeah.
So are people who care about animals making any progress in Brazil as opposed to here?
Yes, they are. They really are. For example, in 2 weeks, I am returning to Brazil, to the state of Bahia, which is in the northeastern part of Brazil, to the city of Salvador, which is famous for its carnival, but it is also, I hope, soon to be famous as the animal law capital of Brazil. They are having the second annual International Conference on Animal Rights, which is sponsored by the Institute for Animal Abolition, which comes out of is the brainchild of a professor at the Federal University of Bahia, and it has attracted a lot of attention both internationally and domestically. There are a lot of Brazilians speaking at it, and there's I think a great deal of interest. And for example, right before I left Brazil, I gave a week-long course on animal law at the Getúlio Vargas Foundation, and then there was a lot there, and I had one professor there who drove I think 80 miles each night to attend the class. He's the only full-time professor of animal law in Brazil. That is to say, he teaches it every year, and he's a full-time faculty member.
Well, that sounds like great news. I'm very excited. I wish I could go to that conference.
I think we actually heard about that conference from your blog, Animal Blog, and that's blog, like I'm from New Jersey, which I am, but ignore that. It's spelled B-L-A-W-G. Tell us about Animal Blog, one of our very favorite blogs out there.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the Animal Blog is the reason it's the New Jersey pronunciation is because it's a animal law blog. That's and so it's a forum to discuss animal law policy and ethics. There are some other animal law blogs out there that tend to be explicitly sort of case oriented, whereas my blog tends to be more policy and law oriented. And it's been great. It's now 2 years old, almost exactly 2 years old, and it's grown enormously. It's now getting there are new folks starting to contribute on a regular basis, and it's doing controversy, which is always nice, and it's also starting to get some respect in the environmental law community, which is again one of these outreach projects which I've been very anxious to achieve.
Yeah, that's a really terrific goal for that blog, and I think it's the one that can do that, because really you really do tackle some interesting issues in really interesting ways and have some provocative points of view. I recommend anybody to check it out.
What's the URL of your blog, David?
It is Animal Blog, one word, animalblawg.wordpress.com.
Very cool. And
yeah.
So what do you think, speaking of the provocative issues, what do you think are some of the most important issues facing those who wish to improve the law for animals?
Well, as will come as no surprise to you folks who work a lot with this as well, I think the agriculture issue is hugely important. I don't think there's anything that's more important, surely, because of the sheer volume of animals that are used and murdered every year. And because of the billions of animals and because of the international scope of this problem, I think that's the most urgent issue. And in fact, let me just go back to what you asked me earlier. One of the things in terms of crossover between environmental law and animal law, I just recently published a piece with the Animals and Society Institute, which is a wonderful organization.
We love them.
Yeah, they really are great. And it's on CAFOs, industrial agriculture, and climate change. And here's the perfect crossover issue. You know, environmentalists are concerned with nothing more than they're concerned with climate change. And here's agriculture being a huge contributor to it. And if you can't separate the way the animals are warehoused with the way it's causing climate change, you can't separate the two things. So whether or not one chooses to go the extra step and examine the ethics of warehousing animals, one can simply say, well, we can't do this because it's bad for the environment.
So you and Marianne both teach animal law, so I'm in very good company of animal law professors here, and I'm slightly intimidated. How do you, David, teach animal law? Do you find that there is a high level of student interest, and what issues are your students most intrigued by?
I think what I like about teaching animal law is generally I get a real cross-section. I get people who are skeptical or don't care at all and are just taking the class because it fits with their schedule. I get the people who are interested because either they're environmentalists or they like pets, or you know, they volunteered at the Humane Society or something like that. But they have a they have an interest in animals, but it hasn't been fully realized in the sense that that they're interested in the law. And then you have the people who are passionate animal advocates. And what I try to do is I try to meet everybody with a sort of sense of skepticism, you know, push people to explain and undergird their beliefs. And I think that's my way of trying to create a safe place for everybody to feel like they can say whatever they want to say, even if they're skeptical or if they're passionate, but they have to do it respectfully. And I tend to start with a what is animal law and why would we want to study it, and then progress through torts, criminal law, constitutional law. I spend a fair amount of time on constitutional law. And then the end of the last three or four classes deal with the jurisprudence of rights.
Yeah, I would say that I have the exact same experience in the assortment of students in the class. And I think it makes for a really interesting mix. And if you can get them to talk, which is always a challenge in teaching, mm-hmm. but is the key to making the class interesting. Yeah, the interaction among those different viewpoints from which people are coming to the class can be really interesting. And some of the most interesting insights, I think, come from those people who are taking it because they think they've got an opening and they think it won't be that hard and what the hell, and they've never thought about the issue before, and they just need a class that will fit in that time slot.
They sometimes
are just totally blown away by finding out so much about it. No preconceptions.
I think that's true, and I think one of the things that you do that I like, and I think I'm going to try and integrate into my teaching, is you have them do presentations on particular issues that I believe you draw them at random, don't you?
Yeah, I have them draw them at random because I always think it's good for students to explore an area that, you know, that they haven't, that isn't their pet, so to speak, issue, and to find out something new. And I find the student presentations to be so interesting. I frequently learn a lot myself. And then it's not mm-hmm. me feeding the students information. They're getting it on their own, which I think is always helpful. So, yeah, I found that to be a really enjoyable part of the class. Plus, I don't have to talk. Have you seen a shift in the level of respect afforded to animal law within your institution, within society, within organizations?
Well, I think I have. I think so. I mean, in terms of my university, there's certainly, or my law school, I think so. I think animal law has become something that they expect and tolerate, if not are genuinely a little bit intrigued by. Some people are still very skeptical, but there's more people are now genuinely interested. And with respect to the world at large, or the legal community at large, I think for sure, because we've managed to create an animal law section of the American Association of Law Schools, which means that every year at the annual meeting we have a forum where we have speakers, and now it's an accepted discipline within legal academia, which it was when I first came to teaching. And again, we're just talking about 7 or 8 years, so that's been a seismic shift, and you can speak, I think, as well to the overall standing within the bar of the animal law section, which has been, I think, the growth and the output and the level of respect has really, I think, mushroomed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you still get a lot of people who are like, huh, what, animal law? But, you know, they're fewer and further between. I think Bob Barker's money has had a lot to do with it, but to be a little cynical. But I think also just there's an increasing recognition on the part of a lot of people in society, lawyers included, that these issues are huge and very important.
Yeah, and you know, I think even if it were just Bob Barker's money, I take that as a very hopeful sign. Because that's just one guy. Sure, it's a rich guy, but it's one guy, you know, doing something that has genuinely changed a lot of people's approach. And if it's just one guy can do that, imagine if we had 3 or 4 or 5 people, and then a dozen, and then things can really start moving.
So, David, what inspires you and what irks you?
Wow. What inspires me? I guess it's two things. It's the savagery and the beauty. It really is. It's the savagery with which we approach other other sentient beings. I just was blogging about this yesterday about some beagles who were rescued, and there's a U.S. News article about how these beagles had never seen sunlight, had never been had any sort of interaction with each other or with people. They had lived a life of lab sterility, and so they were now being rescued, and they didn't know what to do. The article talked about how they were, but because they're beagles and because they're friendly and social, they adapted quickly. And of course, they were chosen for these experiments because they were friendly and social. And I read that like 3 weeks ago, and I've been haunted by that ever since. Because what does it say about us that we would choose a friendly, trusting, loving animal to experiment on because it's friendly, trusting, and loving? It's the poster, I think, for dysfunctional barbarism, and that inspires me because I can't stand it. I can't stand to be a member of a species that does things like that. Then there's the beauty, which is every time I walk outside, every time I interact, I believe that there's so much. We're surrounded by so much beauty, and every day is a gift, and one has to, I think, make the most of it every way we can. And part of what I think is entailed in making the most of it is thinking about what's important and doing important things. Mm-hmm. And so that's the joyful side of it.
Wow, that's quite an answer. And what irks you?
What irks me is the kind of good-natured dismissal that these issues and consequently I get from those who remain oblivious or uninterested in what we do. People who would otherwise engage won't engage, either because it will impact their diet or because, for whatever reason, they've been socialized to be indifferent. And it irks me, even as I know I used to be one of those people, so it's not like I think, oh, they're bad people, but on a daily basis, it wears me down.
Yeah, the good-natured dismissal is perhaps the most infuriating one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. The offhand kind of smiling, oh, these loony people kind of stuff.
Right, like the uncomfortable laugh. Ha ha ha.
Yes, yes.
Oh, they're vegan. Ha 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 ha.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, I'm sure you inspire many, many people, including Marianne and I. So thank you for inspiring us today and sharing your wise words with us. And we will keep up with you, as we always do, on Animal Blog, which I love to say in addition to read, because it makes me connect to my roots as a Jersey girl.
And we hope to see you someday in Brazil.
Thank you so much, David, for joining us today in our hen house.
It's been an honor and a pleasure. And I hope to do it again.
That was David Casuto. Check out Animal Blog. Thank you, David, for joining us. And let's get right into some news now, shall we? There was an article in the New York Times earlier this week that talked about Ohio's recent decision to ban certain types of confinement systems for farm animals.
Yeah, I think that the Times was really pointing out some important improvements that are going on in the world of farm animal law, and is finally seeming to catch on. They were really talking about the ballot initiatives in a way that they actually seem to recognize that this is news, which is kind of a new thing, and noticing that there's a real trend going on here and the changes are going to have to be made in this industry. It was good to see because, you know, the New York Times is pretty unaware of these issues a lot of the time, and it's good to see that a real mainstream media outlet is paying attention to this and taking it seriously.
The article was called Farmers Lean to Truce on Animals Close Quarters, and what I particularly appreciated about the article was not so much the recognition of what's going on, though I appreciated that as well, but rather they talked about how big of a space, or should I say small of a space, chickens have and pigs have and cows have to live their entire lives. And they did it with very passionate language that you would more likely see on an animal rights website. So I thought that that was a good thing.
Yeah, that was good that they did actually get down to the really brass tacks and talk about what's really going on. I did feel that they didn't really describe the conditions in a factory farm. They talked about the basic facts, the confinement, but they kind of just reported on the quote-unquote farmers who said that the animals are quote-unquote happy or that this is an appropriate way to do things. And it didn't sound like they were reporting about what's really going on in those factory farms, the nightmarish horror that exists there. And it's hard to believe that a reporter actually was inside one of those facilities writing this article. They kind of made it sound, they didn't make it sound good, but they didn't make it sound as hideous and disgusting and filthy and dreadful as we all know it is.
That's a very good point. Also in the news, from Time magazine this time, was an article called Inside the Minds of Animals. And a small piece of this article is available online on the Time magazine website, time.com.
I think it's an important article. It's disappointing in a way to see that so much of our information about animals is taken from kind of oppressive research. A lot of it was about Kanzi, very famous bonobo in language studies conducted by Sue Savage Rumbaugh, the very famous primatologist. And, you know, it is disappointing to see information coming from those sources, but this was a real breakthrough article, I think. It's hard to believe that people aren't becoming more and more aware that we can't just hide behind this delusion that animals don't matter, that they are not feeling anything, that they are not suffering, that they can't experience joy the same way we can, and that they deserve to have those things in their lives, and that they are it's not appropriate for us to think of them as our slaves, as our food. The article certainly didn't go that far, but it's hard to imagine that that isn't the logical conclusion, except, of course, for its comment about cows.
Right. It did say that cows, unlike primates and certain types of sea life, are not intelligent, which is, of course, bullshit. And, in fact, they are incredibly intelligent beings, as most people who are listening to this probably know, and anybody who has ever met a cow at an animal sanctuary knows as well. Here's a piece of the article that I found worthy of reading. Humans have a fraught relationship with beasts. They are our companions and our laborers. We love them and cage them, admire them and abuse them. And, of course, we cook and eat them. Our dodge has always been that animals are ours to do with as we please, simply because they don't suffer the way we do. They don't think, not in any meaningful way. But one by one, the berms we've built between ourselves and the beasts are being washed away. Humans are the only animals that use tools, we used to say, but what about the birds and ape that we now know do as well? And as for humans, as the only beasts with language, Kanzi himself could tell you that's not true. All of that is forcing us to look at animals in a new way. It's not enough to study an animal's brain. We need to know its mind. And of course, I felt uncomfortable reading this, knowing that, you know, we are relying on these ridiculous, stupid, unnecessary science projects to show us that animals have worth. Of course, we don't need these kind of egregious tests to show that animals have worth. But if it's going to result in somebody, or maybe hopefully millions of people, learning that animals have value in and of themselves, then I guess it was not for naught.
Yeah, I can remember myself being compelled by this kind of information that the language studies with chimpanzees, or now bonobos, and I guess they've been done with gorillas as well, and those kinds of things, and the different demonstrations of animal intelligence. And I think it's part of the evolution in your attitude towards animals that you find out that information and you think that's what makes them worth more. But as you start to really dwell on what animals mean and who animals are, you realize that their worth is not because they compare to us well, to humans well, but because they're so extraordinary, each in their own right. And intelligence is really a kind of flawed way of analyzing that. But I think at the same time, this is an enormous step and an enormous recognition and a very important article. I hope it has an impact.
And that was our news.
For our review section today, we will be joined once again by our Hen House's reviewer, Kyle Neese. Welcome back to our Hen House, Kyle.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are excited to hear all about faux gras. And by faux gras, I mean faux gras.
That's right. F-A-U-X. It's this interesting new product available at special stores in New York City, and it's pâté made out of lentils and walnuts and onions and some other seasoning. So it's a cruelty-free and healthful alternative to its cruel cousin, faux gras.
Right. Foie gras is like maybe one of the worst of the worst. So I just love the fact that who makes foie gras?
It's a woman named Ella Nemkova, and she is AKA also known as the Regal Vegan.
Well, I just love that she's doing that. I mean, just the title alone makes me love her.
Yeah, and her whole company is called The Regal Vegan, which is, I like the idea that, you know, I feel like regal isn't usually the first adjective people think of when they think of a vegan. So I appreciate that Ella is out there trying to help change that.
Yeah, that's a good point. We should emphasize how extraordinary and really high-end so many of our foods are.
Definitely, yeah. And I like that this is almost just by the name itself making people think kind of about what foie gras is, you know? And the thing that this just says on it, foie gras, lentil, walnut pate, you know? So that you think automatically that if something like this is made out of lentil walnuts, what is foie gras made of anyway? Doesn't that mean fat liver? Foie gras?
Yeah, it is pretty disgusting when you interpret it, isn't it? Everything sounds better in French.
That's right. Foie gras sounds better, too, although it kind of means fake fat, but at least that sounds better.
I guess it's pretty hard to do a taste comparison test, since we're not going to sit down
Luckily,
and eat any foie gras.
I have never tried foie gras, so I was kind of going off of it from a neutral point. But from what I understand, it is... delicious, but it definitely is mimicking this sort of savory, like, flavor of a pâté. And it's really, like, mild, but it's in a nice, like, nutty lentil and walnut flavor with a sort of, like, umami savory taste to it. It's really delicious. The texture of it is like a spread or like a dip, you know? I've never eaten foie gras, but from what I understand, foie gras is a bit more like solid or fatty. You can like slice it up or something. So this isn't like that. You know, the texture almost resembles like hummus or something, but it is still has that sort of flavor. And I think that the most interesting thing about the product is it has a beautiful label, and it's called foie gras. So the fact that it's trying to market itself as a replacement, I think is really interesting. You know, it is something that is a regal product, and I like that it's trying to fill that niche, you know, for anyone who's interested.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, like I said, I haven't tried it yet, but I like that it's available in stores, and I like that somebody, this woman, Ella, came up with this idea of foie gras and marketed it and did it. I mean, that to me is really incredible activism.
Yeah, it is. And she is a chef. I mean, if you go to her website, theregalvegan.com, she does catering, and she has, like, sample menus. So it's like she could make a lot of different products, but you can tell that she chose to market this one product because she had this idea for a great name, something that people would remember and something that people would be attracted to. So I think that that's an interesting thing is even the, you know, you may have a lot of different skills, but if you have one thing that really sticks, then go with that, you know? So you can tell she definitely made a conscious effort to market this one product, even though she has, you know, thousands of other recipes in her head.
Now, is this available only in New York City?
Yeah, for the moment it is. It's available at natural food stores in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens, but it's growing. The list of places it's available is already growing in New York, and I'm sure it'll grow beyond, you know, but for now, yeah, it's available at independent natural food stores in New York City.
I'm thinking that even for people who are listening to this who are not in New York City, this is a great model for what is possible when you really put your mind to it. I mean, I'm thinking like, well, what other really egregiously cruel products are out there that we can do the same thing to? And veal springs to mind. Maybe we could have veal and call it, I don't know, veal.
Well, you know how to say veal in French actually is veau. So you could even say faux-veau. It rhymes.
I love that.
There you go. You heard it here first on Our Hen House. Well, that's
faux-veau.
Thank you so much, Kyle. I definitely have to pick some up. I'll have to, I saw it once at a store in Brooklyn Heights. I'm going to have to go back to that store where I know they have it and pick some faux gras up. And in the meantime, if people also don't have it available, they could make, really easily make a vegan pâté. I mean, I know where you work, Kyle, at Sacred Chow's, maybe my favorite pâté I've ever had in my life. And, you know, people could call it whatever they want to call it, bring it to the family reunion and have a nice, compassionate, healthy dish available.
Yeah, and it's really healthy. I mean, that's one of the things about foie gras is almost no one is allergic to it. You know, lentils, and I mean, people are allergic to nuts, but so many things are made with a lot of gluten or a lot of soy products, or this is a product that's made from lentils and walnuts, you know, so it's a nice product for a lot of different people to be able to try.
Cool. Well, I'm hungry now. Are you hungry?
Yeah, I would definitely like to try a little of that right now.
Okay. And by the magic of the garage band on the Mac, foie gras has appeared through our computer. No, I'm kidding. Well, thank you so much, Kyle, for joining us and giving us your thoughts about foie gras. We look forward to hearing more from you about more great products that and books and movies that people need to get out and try for the sake of the animals.
Let's do it. I look forward to being back.
Awesome. Take care.
You too.
Thank you. That was our podcast for today. Thank you so much for joining us today in Our Hen House. Please visit our website, ourhenhouse.org. Email us at info@ourhenhouse.org. Become our Facebook fan. If you like what you're listening to, please leave us a friendly, groovy review on iTunes. Thank you in advance for that. Come to our launch party on October 1st at 8 p.m. in New York City. You can find out more information about that on our website, ourhenhouse.org. Click on Party Dime, which is on the top right-hand corner. And we will be joined at our launch by Jane Velez-Mitchell, Victoria Moran, Joshua Ketcher, and many, many others. So we hope to see you there, and we hope that you have an awesome rest of your weekend.